to go back a little bit, what kind of Cleveland concert experiences did you have with Cooper through the early days? Were you playing Cleveland pretty regularly early on?
Yeah, we played, well, the Northern Akron and Cleveland area. And I remember I still, you know, because I mean, being from Akron, when we played at the, we had played early on at a theater, and I'm not going to remember the name of the theater off the top of my head. And that was a great show for us there. It was right in Akron. And actually, some of the, a girl and a guy that I went to junior high and high school with came to the show. And at that time, you know, I left, it had been about 10 years since I'd been there. And, you know, when you're 23, 24 years old, that's a long time.
Right. And when, what time period was this?
Pardon me?
What time period was this?
This was probably now right around Love It to Death.
Okay. So,
I mean, we'd already, you know, we were already pretty well known.
So before Love It to Death, were you playing this area?
Yeah,
at all?
I mean, we played through the Midwest so many times, so many different places, and I'm not going to remember them all. But we did play through Cleveland and Akron area. Cause I remember because, you know, at the time when I passed through, I would always call my relatives and what have you.
So as early as Pretty's for You, you were...
Yeah, I can go back and check, but I don't know about Pretty's for You. I think we had played some shows up around Michigan, but I really don't think until Love It to Death we really got into the Cleveland area. I can't say for sure, you know, I do have all these dates. I did take a log of all these dates. I'm the only person in the band that did. I have the most authentic, you know, in my archives, I have the most accurate, I should say, you know, touring schedule from those days.
Well, that's cool.
And so if I ever write a book, I'll probably put those in there on a page or something.
You should do a book.
But I think that I know especially we played the Rubber Bowl because I thought, oh man, this would be so great. And the security guys had a black and red T-shirt on. It was made of some I don't know, nylon or rayon. I mean, it still looks today as new as the day it was made. I still have it. It says the Akron, Ohio Akron Rubber Bowl on it. It's one of my favorite shirts. I mean, when I was in the marching band at Buchtel High School, I used to, for Derby Downs, which was, you know, close to the Rubber Bowl, Derby Downs, I marched down the hill in the band. God bless my mom. I just went through some old slides, and she actually has some photographs of the Buchtel High School marching band.
Oh, wow.
In 1961, coming down... 63, coming down the hill at Derby Downs, and one of these days I'm going to put them on my website.
Same hill that you would dominate later with the band.
Huh?
The same hill you would dominate later with the band.
I guess so, yeah.
So what other Cleveland shows, any other ones that stand out in your memory?
No, we played whatever the arena was up in Cleveland, that's where we played then, you know, basically after.
Coliseum?
Yeah, the Coliseum up there, yeah. And all I can ever tell you is that you know, the audience in Cleveland were just like Detroit. They were some of the craziest, freaking wildest, you know, party people I've ever seen in my life. So, you know, it felt good to be, like, you know, at home and see that I really wasn't as crazy because everybody from where I came from, you know, sort of like, you know, my family area of the country, was equally as nuts as I was. Or Glenn, too. So that was great. No, we had great times there. Are you kidding me? Great tours.
Next for you, then, would be the Dead Ringer Project?
Yeah, late 80s. Dennis and Joe Bouchard, actually, to back up a few years before that, 1985, there was a huge, there's a big outdoor event, the biggest outdoor event that draws about a million people every year on a long weekend here in southern Connecticut. It's called the Norwalk Connecticut Oyster Festival. And in 1985, Cyndi Lauper was supposed to make her Connecticut debut at the Oyster Festival. And on the Saturday night, they have the big concert that has about, you know, 10 or 15,000 people there. And about 2 weeks before the show, Cyndi canceled on them for whatever reason. I don't know, but she canceled the show. And all of a sudden, we knew the person that had booked the show was a good friend of Joe Bouchard's. He called Joe and said, Joe, you know, can you put something together for us here? And, you know, we're dire straits of a band that, you know, has some national recognition, and to, you know, to do the headline spot here. And you know, I said, you want to know how much we would want to get paid? And I said, look, Joe, they're in a jam. Let's ask for a lot of money. We did, and they paid us. So it was the very first time Dennis and Joe and I had been writing songs for a few years, and because he lived right here in the same town that I do in Connecticut. And so we put the band together, and we did some classic Alice Cooper, did some classic Blue Oyster Cult, did some old Yardbird songs, some old rock and roll, some Chuck Berry, some, I don't know, just a you know, like an hour and a half worth of songs, and some original songs we'd written too. And went up there, and we, you know, we had the pyro and the lights, and it was a great show. I mean, yeah, we did one show. That was the very first show we ever did together. So now to back up to Dead Ringer, that was essentially the core of Dead Ringer. And another friend of mine that was Charlie Hune, who was one of the guitar player and backup singer for Ted Nugent,
mm-hmm.
Back on like the Intensities album and that time period of Ted. And in the early 80s, Ted had played at the New Haven Coliseum, and Charlie was there with him. And I hadn't seen the guy since, you know, because we used to party together in Detroit all the time, and it was about 10 years earlier. And while they were there, Charlie sang lead on a couple of songs, and I went, wow, this guy's a phenomenal singer. I said, Charlie, man, I said, I talked to him after the show. I said, if I ever put something together, man, and need a really screaming singer, would you be interested in doing it? And he said, yeah, if I'm available, I would. So after that point, he actually went to Germany and did a couple albums in Germany with a great band over there. And then he came back, and I hooked up with him, and we had an opportunity with this. When Columbia Records sold out to Sony Records, some of the executive left, and they formed a company called Grudge Records. And they were going to try to, you know, establish this grudge-based record label against Columbia. Anyway, we were one of the first bands that they signed was Dead Ringer. They contacted because I knew one of the guys that was, one of the presidents or the vice presidents of the new record label. And they, you know, again, they wanted some band with some national status and one of the band with some national recognition. And so Joe and Dennis and I. Well, the core of the band, and Joe at that time was basically playing guitar and keyboards. He played basses, you probably remember, with Blue Oyster Cult, but
right.
He was originally a guitar player. So it was sort of like when Noel Redding came in with Jimi Hendrix Experience. He was originally a guitar player and played bass for Jimmy.
Right.
When Joe Bouchard came into Blue Oyster Cult, he was originally a guitar player and then played bass for Blue Oyster Cult. And so he wanted to get back to playing bass and playing guitar and keyboards, and that's one reason he left Blue Oyster Cult. So he was playing keyboards and guitar, and we got another guitar player, a friend of mine named Jesse Johnson, who lived up in the Hartford area. And then we needed a singer, and so I contacted Charlie in Detroit, and he came out, and we put the Dead Ringer album together and recorded it. And it's a great record. I still sell it on my website and still sell quite a few copies of it. But that was how that project came together, and it was, you know, typical, 80s sounding band, you know, hair band, and but there were some great songs, and I was very proud of the album.
So was Cinematic next?
No, actually, after that,
Bruce Cameron, right?
Yeah, Bruce Cameron, who I don't know if you know much about his story.
I really don't.
The guy that helped Mike Bruce write his book back in the mid-90s, it lived in South Carolina. His name was Billy James. And Billy has known people from the Mothers and from that era of rock and roll and that genre of rock and roll and helped them with different musical, you know, avenues in their careers to help write books or do records or whatever. And so he had hooked up with Michael and helped him write his book, which was called, I think, No More Mr. Nice Guy. And that was released in the mid-90s. And so I had talked to Billy a couple of times, and through our communication, a friend of his who was this guy down in South Carolina that he came from a fairly wealthy family, Bruce Cameron, and he was putting together a solo record. Didn't have a deal, but he was going to do his own deal. He's going to put his own record company together, which his family certainly could do. And so, you know, we made arrangements, and Michael was going to be on the album. I was asked to do four songs on the album. Mitch Mitchell from the Jimi Hendrix Experience played on the album. Buddy Miles played on the album.
Jack Bruce?
Jack Bruce played on the album, exactly. And somebody from... Was it Uriah Heep, one of those bands from Detroit, also played on the album. So it was a pretty star-studded, roster of musicians on the record. And so I was pretty happy to be involved with it. and it all, you know, all worked out, and it was a great, it was a fun project to do more than anything else. And, you know, I wished him a lot of luck, and, you know, he was a good guy. It was pretty crazy. I mean, Bruce was a pretty crazy guy. And so the album was released in, I think, was it 97, Rose? I think, yeah, 90, around 97. And I went down to South Carolina, and they took really good care of me and went down there and recorded the record. And within 6 months, he was having an argument with his girlfriend, took out a revolver and blew his brains out.
Wow.
And, you know, and Mike Bruce was on the record, too, had done a couple songs, and everything sounded great. And, you know, he had the star-studded record, and everything, he'd always, you know, it was like, you know, if you're a guitar player, a musician, it's like a dream come true to put together your dream band, which he could do, which he certainly had the ability to do with his family and what have you. And then he did that, so, you know, it was pretty crazy.
Was the record doing very well at that time?
Yeah, it was, you know, they were selling it on the Internet, you know, he certainly was a capable guitar player, wrote all the songs and what have you, and you know, it's just one of those crazy things. I mean, it was all right. I unfortunately I don't have any copies of it to sell, but I think it still could be found. You know, Bruce Cameron search on Google. I'm sure you could probably still find it, because I know they still have copies of it.